The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Saulnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition, where we're going to do our best to answer your questions, mostly that you've sent in via email, but today we have kind of a special occasion, and we are going to take a live caller first off here. So
they jumped to the top of the line. He knew the trick.
Not only did he jump to the top of the line, he must have been waiting, watching for us to go live. Mm-hmm. So
because the Go Pats trick,
he's right here,
work.
So here he comes.
Nope, you just hung up on him.
I did.
Well, that wasn't
very
nice.
Hang on, hang on. Hi, this is Chris and Jim on the Retirement and IRA Show. Hello?
Hey, this is Rich.
Hey, Rich, how are you doing? We can call you Rich if that's okay with you. It's a little too late to call you George because now Rich has kind of gone out over the airwaves. Yeah. But
maybe his real name is George and he wants to be called Rich. We don't know that.
Well, I know it because I see the caller ID.
I do hear that you are from West Virginia.
I am, yes.
That would be right next to the fine state of Kentucky. Have you ever been to Kentucky?
I have.
In the summer?
Great state. I've been there in the summer and the winter. It's a great state.
A great state. Did you hear that, Chris?
I heard that. Maybe you should visit it sometime and see for yourself.
How would you describe the summer on a scale of 1 to 10? 10 being, oh my God, this humidity is killing me. One being, this is no problem.
You know, there are times when it's a 10.
Ooh.
Unbearable.
There you
but
go.
But it's not all summer. It's just occasionally.
Okay.
And is West Virginia a 10?
No.
No.
No. Right, it's an 8, no. Maybe a 9 sometimes.
Okay. See, better than 10, but
better
anyway.
Than 10. All right.
So now that Jim got all of his questions answered, we'll move on to...
We'll move on to your
we'll
question.
We'll move on to Richard's question. So what have you got for us today, Rich?
So I'm planning to file for my Social Security benefits this year. Mm-hmm. I have a child. Well, we have a child who is under 16. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to find out how much his benefit's going to be. And I see on my Social Security statement, it actually lists a maximum amount that the child and the spouse who's caring for that child can get. Mm-hmm. And it also has a total family benefits number.
Right.
And I'm trying to find out how those numbers are determined and if they're accurate, that kind of thing.
They are accurate. Now, the benefit statement you're talking about must be a kind of a something you pulled online or something they gave you in the office. Is that true?
That's true. Yeah, I just downloaded it today.
Okay. Okay. So when you have there's two things that are triggered when you file for your own benefit. It opens the door to a spousal benefit for a spouse who is of Social Security claiming age themselves, 62 or above. So that would be a typical case. Or in a case where you have children under the age of 16, your spouse actually qualifies for a spousal benefit with no age restriction. That's the trigger. That's the child being under 16 is what kind of opens the door to a spousal benefit. They call it a child in care benefit, spousal benefit, to just distinguish it from a traditional spousal benefit. And so that is opens the door to that. And then the child themselves is entitled to a benefit as well, up to the age of 18 or 19 if they're still in high school. Where it coordinates is each one of those additional beneficiaries on your record, if you will, while you're alive, is entitled to one half of your full retirement age benefit with a cap called the family maximum. So they do limit the total that can be collected on a single, what they call, number holder's record. So you are the number holder, very generic term for the person who's actually generated the benefit under which these other folks are claiming a benefit. And the way this is going to coordinate is that family maximum is between 150 and about 185% of your PIA, your primary insurance amount. It's a very complicated formula, so that's why we give it a range, the 150 to 185. Do they give it to you as a dollar amount, or you don't have to tell us the dollar amount, but do they give it as a dollar or a percentage?
No, they actually list a dollar amount.
Okay, so they've done that calculation for you and given you the cap. So what that means is that is the most that can be collected on your Social Security record itself. Now, it'll technically be split. So those auxiliary benefits, you'll be collecting your own, whatever that was determined to be. And then any auxiliary benefits up to the family maximum will be split between, in this case, your spouse and your child. The child's benefit will be paid to you as their custodian, essentially, but there'll actually be two separate benefits. Once the child reaches 16, the child in care spousal benefit will shut off. The idea or the concept behind that is once they're 16, your spouse doesn't really have as much obligation to stay home from work to take care of them and that sort of thing, so they don't need the benefit anymore. So that shuts off. The fascinating thing is your benefit may very well not go down much at that time because the benefit now payable to the child will stay under the family maximum. It's not going to be limited. So what a lot of people find is whether it's themselves, a spouse, and a child, or themselves and just the child, the total benefit is relatively similar.
Oh, I see.
So you've got in front of you what I would hope, since it came directly from Social Security, accurate numbers there. So for you, if both the child and your spouse were to collect, you'd be collecting that family maximum that they've listed for you there.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Excellent.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then how old is your child?
He'll be 9 this year.
Okay, so you've got quite a few years before he turns 16. And so during that time, those will be there. Now, do know that the child in care spousal benefit for your spouse is subject to the earnings test. So if your spouse works, that benefit might be reduced or eliminated due to that. But if they're a stay-at-home spouse caring for the child, that's the idea of it, is to pay when they are unable to work because they're helping take care of your child, wouldn't necessarily be affected. And your earnings, if you're still working and subject to the earnings test, can also trickle down and reduce those benefits as well. So that's the only other thing we haven't talked about that could affect things here is her earnings wouldn't affect your benefit because that's kind of upstream. You're the benefit earner, but your earnings can actually affect your own benefit and all under you, all the auxiliary and spousal benefits being paid as well. So be sensitive to that if either one of you were planning to work simultaneously while collecting. Sometimes if that's the case, if your spouse is still working, it'll make sense just to collect yours and your child's alone, not try to claim the spousal because it'll be offset anyway. But that's, you know, we don't have to get into all that, but I want to make you aware that there is that one extra component to consider out there, the earnings test.
Yeah. I'm aware of that. That's good to remember though.
Okay.
So when my child turns 16 and the, spousal payment stops, does the fact that she's been collecting a benefit, will that affect her own benefit when she decides to start?
It does not. It does not. It typically would, but essentially the child in care trigger absolves or removes any of the effects of early claiming. It removes the limit of claiming younger than 62, and it removes any early reductions or anything like that happen. Essentially, they waive any of the age-related effects of the benefit when there's a child involved. That was the special exception that they make for the child in care spousal benefit. Yeah, so it won't. Her choice to do that later on when she were to claim her own. If she were to claim her own or a traditional spousal at 62, of course, it'll be reduced because she's claiming early at that point. But if she were to wait till her full retirement age, the fact that years ago she might have claimed a child in care spousal benefit won't affect the benefit at that point.
All right. Very good.
Okay.
Very good.
Great. Well, excellent question, and we really appreciate you calling in. We don't get a whole lot of live calls, but they're always fun to actually talk to somebody. So,
but yeah, you guys put on a great show.
Thank you. We do appreciate that, and thank you for your advice on Connecticut. Where am I going?
You're going to Kentucky or Kentucky. West Virginia.
Well, maybe West Virginia now.
Yeah,
I broke down in West Virginia. I was driving back from Colorado.
Don't hold that against him.
No, it's not his fault.
Right.
I'm just saying it was a pretty state.
It's very pretty.
The mountains are not quite Colorado-esque, but it was very green. It was very green. It was really nice.
Yeah.
And my water pump let go and
Because it was so hot.
It wasn't hot. Anyways, I do appreciate it, but I did break down in West Virginia and spent several hours there, and the people were very friendly, and I thought it was a very beautiful state, and maybe someday I will be your neighbor.
Excellent. Thank you both very much.
Thanks a lot, Rich.
Okay, bye-bye. We have another caller.
What?
Yeah, we got someone from New Jersey with a question on the Secure Act, so he'll be coming up shortly.
This is quite a show.
I know, all of a sudden we're getting to see people know how to jump the line because what I was trying to say before, Go Pats doesn't work anymore.
Because too many people try to use it.
So no, the Pats lost. There's nowhere to go. They went down.
Okay, here we go.
I'm not used to losing.
I guess. Hi, this is Chris and Jim on the Retirement and IRA Show.
Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
Hello, Jim.
How are you? We're going to call you George, or would you like us to call you something else?
You can call me George.
All right, we'll call you George. And rumor has it you're in Jersey?
Yes, I am.
All right, well, I suppose, is it northern, southern, or central?
Central, north central.
North central, okay. All right, Jersey, I can hear it in his accent a little. Can you hear it?
I can tell he's from that area of the country, but not having grown up there, I can't you know, identify specific locations like you might be able to. Right. But.
Have you ever been to Kentucky, George?
Oh, my gosh.
No, but I did send you an email a while back with the report that I forget where it came from, financial planning or something, where they stated that Kentucky was pretty much the worst state in the country to retire to.
Yeah, it wasn't the worst. Pretty much it was the worst, which I did not agree with. They rated it 50.
You've never been there. How are you defending it, not even having been there?
I don't think it's 50. You're telling me it's worse than Mississippi?
Somebody has to be 50. At least they have shrimps down there in Mississippi.
It was in the bottom 10.
Yeah, it was. It was pretty low. And again, I disagree with their findings. Not that I've ever been to Kentucky, but they got 9 years to improve themselves.
Yeah.
That may very well happen.
They very well may rise to the top of the cream or something like that. Okay. Well, I hear you have a question on the SECURE Act.
Yeah, it's more of a comment with a little attached question. But actually, before I get to that, just one comment on the previous caller.
Yeah.
Since I happen to be in the exact same position with two minor children and I'm collecting Social Security, one thing, Chris did mention how hitting the earnings limit when you're under your FRA will reduce everybody's benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a single person or just you and don't have anybody claiming off of your record, it's not as big a deal because that gets imputed back into you, into your amounts in the future when you hit FRA.
Yeah, I know exactly where you're going with this.
But if you have anybody claiming on your record, it's lost forever.
Yeah. Very good points. I didn't share that on the last call, but that's exactly right. What George is referring to there is any auxiliary benefits that are reduced for earnings tests never get recalculated, where your own benefits, your own retirement benefits that are reduced get taken into consideration once you reach full retirement age. They will recompute as if you hadn't claimed as early, essentially kind of removing the penalty, if you will. Now, that doesn't come back to you as a lump sum. It comes back to you over your lifespan as higher benefits. But, yeah, they don't recompute the child or spousal benefits that are lost or reduced because of the earnings test. So that's an excellent point, George.
Yep, I always kept that in mind. And I had a call on the air a couple of years ago where you advised me on many of the technical aspects of this. And I think you did bring it up at the time. So, it helped me out, and certainly okay. I'm trying to keep my earnings down below
right.
that amount. So going to the SECURE Act, my comment is I've heard and read and have been hearing and reading for months and months about SECURE Act and RESA when that was a possibility. And one thing I've never heard of or didn't really catch until just recently when I saw it possibly affecting me was the age of RMD being increased from 70 and a half to 72. That can affect pensions also. And the reason I say that is I have a defined benefit pension from a former employer, which as I'm collecting Social Security now, I'm using similarly to Social Security because it grows at a guaranteed 5% every year until I hit 66. And then it continues to grow at that guaranteed 5%, but they, like Social Security, impute back what you're not taking at that time. So the maximum growth period was through age 70 and a half. I called the custodian the other day to ask if this age would be increased to 72 now, allowing for a couple of years of additional growth of the lump sum or the annuity benefits. And they said, yes, it does, and we are working on changing the modeling calculator, et cetera, to fall into place there. So that has some good planning effects for me, and I would think for your clients, too, to a degree. The question I had, which they couldn't answer, was, are you just doing this because to parallel the RMD age, or is this a legal requirement that you allow the plan to go all the way up to age 72 now before taking any lump sums or annuity payments?
I don't know of any legal requirements requiring that as far as defined benefit goes. So it seems to me like they're just trying to, offer that and tie it into when required minimum distributions begins. But I know of no, now I'm not a defined benefit expert, and I still got to get Vicky on the, not Vivian, what's her name? Valerie. Mm-hmm. On the phone. Valerie is a defined benefit expert, and she might be able to answer that. She has expressed interest on coming on the podcast. I very rarely do Chris and I bring on guests unless it's Pete. But Val has impressed me with her knowledge on defined benefit plans, and she may know the answer to that. And what we could do is reach out to you. Make sure Laura, I'm pretty sure we have your email address, but make sure Laura has it, George. Because if Val's going to be on the show, I'd like to get her and you together. Can two callers be on the same time? Because Val is in Maryland.
We could make that happen, yeah.
Okay. Because I think she would be a better one to answer that. But to the best of my knowledge, and you were shaking your head in agreement, Chris, right. To the best of our knowledge, I don't know of anything in the tax code that requires it to tie into RMD age. And instead, they're just changing their plan to placate that.
Well, the wording of the plan may have just said RMD age, which we all know has been 70 and a half, and it just naturally went up because the RMD age went up, and they're just now having to reformulate their calculations based on this. But yeah, anything that uses wording that ties it to RMD age naturally will now have changed because of that. But I'm not aware, just like Jim, of any specific rule. I haven't read anything in the SECURE Act itself, nor have I seen, there was even no legal requirement I'm aware of that made them go to 70 and a half in the first place. That was just a plan choice.
Okay, that was my thinking at first, that this is just the way they wrote the plan, and now they're adjusting the plan to stay sort of in sync. But it's nice to see, because those extra year and a half, it's about 10% growth per year. So it really is something I'm looking to hang on till I'm 72.
Right. So you're delaying the turning on of your pension to maximize the size, getting advantage of those effectively like delayed retirement credits almost with Social Security.
Exactly, because I claim Social Security at 62 with two minor children.
Yep.
Sort of going the other way.
Yeah.
The only thing it doesn't have is a cost of living increase, but
typical
of
private
that.
Pensions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Government pensions will have it because they're the government, so they're devoid of economic reality.
Well, but a lot of them are starting to limit the COLA, and some don't.
They'll limit,
Texas, for instance, their public pensions, they have to vote in cost of living adjustments, and they haven't done it for quite some time.
But most of the time when you see a COLA adjustment, it'll be a government pension.
Oh, yeah. If you see it, it's almost for sure a government pension. But more and more government pensions are dialing that back as they become less and less fully funded. So,
yes. Yeah. But what we'll do, George, is Valerie is that we spoke about her in the past about how she designs defined benefit plans for small companies and individuals to help reduce taxable income when self-employed. So I'd like to bring her on because I like some of her strategies. But when she's on, if we can get you on as well to ask that question, then we can get both of you on. If anyone is going to know the answer, it will be her or someone at her firm for sure. Her firm just specializes in defined benefit pension plans. So she would definitely know if there is a tie-in specifically to RMD age, or if the plan, like Chris was thinking, might have in its documents that it keys off of RMD age, and they may have never even thought RMD age would get changed, or they never even factored that in. So maybe they worded it as RMD age.
Sorry about that.
Oh, that's okay. We thought you hung up on us.
Talking to me.
No, you got more important things to do, we see.
No, I'd say it's not that. It's just my computer started up playing the Mixler. I had it on mute, but I guess it popped off. But no, I remember hearing the discussion a few weeks ago about the defined pension plans for small businesses, and Valerie, I'd be glad to speak with her.
Yeah, and she, again, has expressed interest in coming on. I've just never arranged it. So we'll have to do that. Mm-hmm. I've been in contact with her lately for something she's helping in my office. So I will, next time I have her on the phone, see when she wants to come on, because I love what she does. I love her service. And again, it's very rare that Chris and I bring people on, especially people who offer services that we don't. But I just think what she offers is pretty valuable. And a lot of our listeners could benefit from it. It's a niche for sure. I think you would agree, Chris. But any listeners who fall into that category of being self-employed, mm-hmm. She has some really good strategies to maximize retirement savings. So I will definitely bring her on and hopefully get that question answered with a little more certainty than Chris and I, assuming there's no relationship between RMDs.
Yeah, and I'll take a quick look to see if I find anything obvious, yeah. And I'll mention it on the show if I do.
But so. In the meantime, enjoy the fact that they're going to give you another year and a half of deferral and growth in that, because I think it's a great benefit.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Great.
Perfect. All righty, George. We will be in touch. Make sure Laura has a way to get a hold of you, and we'll work with getting Valerie on. May not be for a few more weeks, but we'll try to arrange all this and get it going.
Okay, whenever, it's fine.
Perfect. Okay. All right.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for the call.
Talk to you later.
Okay, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Strong Jersey accent on George.
I agree.
And one thing tying into that Secure Act, we've received a few questions on it. One was today someone called the office and Laura came in and wanted me to answer the question real quick for them. And it was... they're going to be turning 70 and a half this year, and they wanted to know if they would still be able to do QCDs, qualified charitable distributions. And my answer was yes, you're going mm-hmm. to be able to. So again, QCDs allow someone, you have to be past the age of 70 and a half, not the year you turn 70 and a half, past the age of 70 and a half. You could donate money directly from your IRA to a charity, and it could be used to reduce your required minimum distribution, because the QCD will apply or reduce or count for your required minimum distribution. So Laura looked at me, Steve. God, I did it again. Well, who the hell is Steve?
I'm not sure.
You don't even look like a Steve. I've known you for 12 years. It's not like your middle name is Steve. I call you Steve all the time. I mean, it's not just a one-time thing.
It's been several lately.
Piss was a one-time thing. But Steve comes out constantly. Chris,
mm-hmm.
not even close to Steve.
I don't know.
But anyways, she looked at me, Chris, and mm-hmm. she said, why would someone want to do that then?
Because they're charitably inclined and want to give out of their IRA.
Well, think about it, because I...
And it'll reduce their future
She RMDs. Probably regretted asking me why, because she had to take a seat, and I started talking to her. But what do you think? Why do you think someone who's RMDs now, because this person who called the office doesn't turn 70 and a half until 2020... So their RMDs, they're under the new law.
Right.
Their RMDs don't begin at 72.
Right.
What do you think I shared with her, and I'm sure you can come up with why I did this, why I said they would still probably want to consider a QCD, even though, because Laura looked at me, she said, why would they want to do a QCD if they're not being forced to take RMDs? I thought QCDs were to reduce... They're RMDs. Do you want to guess on what I shared with our lovely little admin
downstairs? Well, is it more exotic than just the straightforward? I mean, there's two effects. Obviously, any distributions that you get out of there are going to reduce future RMDs to a certain extent, although you're not going to be able to send out enough to make a huge dent in that, but you're going to be able to make tax-free charitable contributions without having to worry about itemizing.
No, you hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, so there's still, obviously you have to be charitably inclined, otherwise...
And I assume this person who called was charitably inclined.
One would think.
And wanted to do the QCDs, but was wondering, can I do them? Now my IMD age is 72, can I still do a QCD this year? So listeners out there who are over 70 and a half, but under 72, and that happens in 2020, so you're under the new rules, you're not under the old rule. I told Laura that I said, well, think of it, Laura. Right now, under the Trump tax cuts, the standard deduction is $24,000 for a married couple. And people over 65, it's like $26,500, or is it 20?
It just went up a little too for 2020.
It's 26 and a half, so it's a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But we'll call it 26 and a half thousand. I said, most people aren't talking about donating that much, but they might want to be donating 5, 10, 15,000 or even 500, I told her. If they were to take that money out of the IRA, they have to declare it as income, and they likely won't get a corresponding deduction on their taxes, because their standard deduction is so high. I said, so it would allow them to donate tax-free from an account that will otherwise be subject to taxes. And it's nice that the QCD reduces your IMDs, but it's not the only reason to use a QCD. Right. And then I went on to tell, and again, by now she's probably regretting asking me this because I know she's busy. So then I went on to tell her that you're allowed to donate up to $100,000 a year. So if this person is charitably inclined and they're looking to lower the value of their IRAs to perhaps reduce future IMDs, now you're talking about being able to give $100,000 over the next year or two. And that could substantially lower the value of an IRA, meaning the RMDs are even lower, possibly giving more tax favor to their Social Security and keeping them perhaps in a lower bracket. So I just wanted to share with Laura, and I don't think she'll ever talk to me again about asking a listener's question, but I wanted to give her ideas of why someone may want to do this. But anyways, that was an interesting question that we got today. I know we addressed it on the podcast in the past, but it was a question that cropped up. We got another email question on the Secure Act that came in this week, and that is, are you grandfather? Gosh, was it grandfathered in on what? I told him that was a very good question, and let me make mention of it. Goodness, I'm going to have to look for that email. I can't remember. But I wrote back to them that that's a very good question, and I will talk about it on a podcast. Did you get that email about are you grandfathered in?
I don't think so.
Does that ring a bell? Let me pull that up. But while I'm doing that, let me just get a Social Security question going because I don't want this awkward pause. Now you can see, folks, that we do these live. We don't redo them. And I know I got that second
Secure Act.
Secure Act question in, and I told the gentleman, hey, that's a good question. You are grandfathered in, but I can't remember in what regard is he grandfathered. I will find it, but in the meantime, I'm going to let Chris answer another question. Why don't you read this one? I don't think you're going to be able to help this person.
Uh-oh.
But they wrote to us almost a month ago, and I wanted to see if you could help them. But I don't think so. It's a frustrating case on that one.
Okay. Let's say, yes, the amazing has happened. I found an error that Social Security made and went down to the office and submitted paperwork to prove the error on July 9th of 2019. I've been fighting till this day for them to correct the error, to which they acknowledged the error in writing. They denied my daughter's benefits and reduced my benefits. Since then, they have paid my daughter their benefits and retroactively. They did correct my monthly payments in November. However, they still owe me $3,300, and the payment processing center has dragged its feet. I contacted my local senator, visited the local office several times, censor, blah, blah, blah. They still haven't paid me nor returned my calls. I went to the local office to file for hardship, and they wouldn't even look at my paperwork. What do I do next? The good news is I think you'll eventually get paid based on the facts you've given me. If there's not more to the story, the fact that it is their error. There's some things that have a statute of limitations on it, but if it turns out to be their error, I've seen them not apply normal statute of limitations where they might want to drag their feet and not do it. Now, taking a long time to fix it, I see that all the time. I hear about that all the time. So I'm not shocked that it is taking you a while to get it. They often do exactly what you're describing, which is immediately fix it going forward. So the benefit got fixed moving forward, but then the retroactive correction, all the payments they should have paid you, I'm guessing, because I see this happen all the time, that the department that deals with that functions completely separately from the department that just fixes it for the ongoing future benefits, where you admit they fixed it moving forward. So they do that so they don't get in the hole with you anymore. But it takes a while to get that lump sum amount, which is likely to come. You've done the right things. Now, my understanding is it's your representative, your congressional representative, not the senator in your area, that is usually the liaison between yourself, between citizens and the Social Security Administration itself. So you might want to check with your local congressman rather than the senator. I would bet the senators have access to the same thing, but since there's only two senators in every state, I don't know what state you're from, but they might be a lot busier with higher level things than your congressman, that there's a lot more of them usually in a state. So they split it up more and they're a little bit more locally focused, mainly because of the election cycle in the House of Representatives versus the Senate. Of course, not to make this a civics lesson, of course, but not that I'm an expert on that anyway. But I tend to get better response from the congressional offices than I've seen from senators. Nothing personal against senators, but that's the only thing I might recommend if you're just being stonewalled here, and reach out to the staff at your representatives, your congressional representative's office, and see if they might be able to help you as well. So I think you're going to get paid. That's you never know when you're dealing with the government or the Social Security office itself, for sure. They might find some reason or technicality not to do it. But based on what you said, I think you'll get paid and you're doing all the right stuff. It's just going to be frustrating until the wheels of justice finally turn slowly enough, around enough for you to get fixed here. So I guess it's not terrible news, Jim. Did you find your elusive email? Excellent.
Yes, I can't write and talk at the same time.
Sorry.
Okay, so we did get this email in a couple of days ago. Jim, just listen to the show on Secure Act. Are existing stretch IRAs grandfathered in?
Yes.
Yes. That was my answer back to him. Mm. Very rarely do I actually email back the answer, but that was so quick.
And you answered it just like that, yes?
No, you know me.
Yeah.
Yes, good point, and I will mention this on a show.
Oh, well, that is a very short answer for,
for me.
For you.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
Usually, if you get a reply back from me, it could be a little bit longer.
Yeah, so they didn't upset the apple cart for everybody that's already been in this situation. It's just moving forward, essentially. So now, they didn't give you a lot of warning. Passed it in December, and oh, by the way, January 1st.
Well, that's what's terrible on it, because it's not giving people a chance to change beneficiary forms, update estate plans, update trust language. And that's what's going to cause a lot of issues
here. So we're a week into January now, and there's 52 weeks, so about 2% of the people who are going to die this year have died at this point. And if they died with bad beneficiary selections because of this change to the stretch, it's too late now.
Yeah.
Right. You got to have the beneficiary designation form done before you die, just like you need homeowners insurance
before
your house.
Some serious work to do. Listen to the old shows on the Secure Act. I will be attending some training sessions on Secure Act. It's as I start to peel this onion back, Chris, and start looking at a trust's now going to be allowed? What is a see-through trust? How are they going to determine that? What happens if someone dies during the delay period? And the person who dies, what if they are an eligible qualified beneficiary and the other spouse, the other decedent wasn't? I mean, all these questions are coming into play that I don't know the answers to. And honestly, I don't know if the industry knows the answers yet to them.
A lot of them won't happen. Won't
until
know until
the IRS
it happens.
Gives guidance. Right. Exactly. So there's a lot of flux with the Secure Act. But the key to remember, folks, and Chris and I had been saying it for quite a while, the stretch IRA has gone the way of the dodo bird. And a lot of you do-it-yourselfers who are listening to us have amassed millions of dollars, which is great. Pat yourself on the back for that. But you did it all in qualified, always taxable, as we call them here on the podcast, always taxable accounts. And they're going to be leaving a tax nightmare to not necessarily the surviving spouse, but whoever inherits it after that, especially if it's a human that's going to inherit it after that. That's where a lot of the issues are going to be. And it's because a hell of a lot of your IRA and other types of always taxable qualified accounts are going to be lost to taxes. And in defense, not in defense, yeah, maybe that's the word, I don't know. But in defense of the Secure Act, at least the senator who sponsored it, I forgot his name, the gentleman who sponsored it in the Senate, freely admitted that provision was to generate revenue. At least they're admitting it. They're not trying to hide behind the Supreme Court in 2015 ruling that when a non-spouse beneficiary inherits an IRA, it's to receive no creditor protection because it's not a retirement account. He wasn't trying to hide behind that, which is what a lot of spineless politicians, and that's a little redundant, but a lot of spineless politicians would have done. Oh, well, the Supreme Court ruled it's not a retirement account, so we're just...
Because they don't want to admit right. what it truly is.
Oh, no,
which
they,
is
he freely
raiser.
Admitted it. This yeah. is to raise revenue. Yeah. Absolutely, good. To raise revenue. And that's why I feel 10 years is going to become 8 or 5 mm-hmm. in the future. Now, are we talking 2 years into the future or 20 years into the future? I don't know. But I think that 10-year number is also
probably
not
at
long.
Risk long yeah. term. Yeah.
Yes, it was also at risk. Because it's so easy, we're just going to change this. Right. We're going to change it back to where it's always been, right. 5 years. It's right. always been that. So I just see them doing that, very defendable. But at least he admitted it. This is to raise revenue. Okay, so that's going to be probably an overriding theme of our podcast as this year goes on. We are going to be doing a lot of shows on the taxation issues of the Secure Act. And we have actually new hires who are going to be coming on the podcast, probably not right away because they'll probably not work for us if they have to come on the podcast right away. But we
not that scary.
Well, we recently hired... two certified public accounting CPAs. We're interviewing a third, not sure if they'll get the position or not, as well as another CFP. So we're going to be bringing on some of these tax people to start talking about a lot of these tax concepts. See, that's what Chris and I do. We just go out and hire the people we need to come answer a lot of these more tax-specific questions because we're busy doing other things. But you'll start hearing some of these people coming on. And Joe Montana, she is going to be leaving the podcast. When does she leave? When's her last day?
End of April, maybe?
I think it's somewhere in April, right after mm-hmm. tax season. Mm-hmm. So Joe is going to be moving on. She has several children and a husband and apparently not as much time as she thought.
Well, in her own tax consulting business.
Plus her own
business.
Tax consulting yeah. practice. Mm-hmm. Well, she loves to represent people in front of the IRS. Mm-hmm. And that's what her passion is. And she wants to go back to doing that as opposed to helping people avoid getting in front of the IRS. She wants to work with people who've already screwed up, as opposed to keeping them from screwing up. Hmm. But
you need those folks too.
She is teaching the new CPAs that we brought on board everything that we do. So we'll try to get Joe on the show a few more times before she moves on as well, and then the new CPAs will come on board. Okay, so that'll be some changes that you'll see here on our podcast in our office. Okay, let's get into some questions here that I had. Okay, so here is, that's a new one. I should try to make older questions jump to the top of the list. Okay. Do you want to do another Social Security or you want to break away from Social Security?
I'm flexible.
Okay. Okay, so this begins. Dear Jim and Chris, a big fan of the podcast. Thank you for your contributions to the U.S. retirement world.
Wow, that's pretty grandiose, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks, Mom.
Yeah.
And that's not my mom. Actually, I don't know where this person is from. But anyways, if half the financial advisors out there were as knowledgeable as you guys, it would be a much better world for people who need help with their retirement. Wow,
there's a lot of schmoozing going on in this one.
That's
I'm blushing.
I think it is from my mom. Yeah. Even my mom don't schmooze this much. Yeah. I got a quick question regarding the backdoor Roth conversion. Mm-hmm. I don't have a traditional, nor do I have a Roth IRA currently, but I do have a simple IRA. And my simple IRA is not 2 years old yet. That's an important bit of info this person gives, by the way. I plan to open a traditional IRA at Charles Schwab and then do a backdoor conversion of this traditional IRA into a Roth IRA, also to be opened at Charles Schwab. However, Charles Schwab's website states the following, and then they quote directly from Schwab's site. If your IRAs contain non-deductible after-tax contributions, your conversion will consist partially of non-deductible and partially deductible contributions and earnings. You will be taxed based on the percentage of after-tax and pre-tax.
Otherwise known as the pro-rata rule.
So there's nothing wrong with any of that right there. Then she asks, I am wondering if this statement will apply to my simple IRA.
Yes.
Is that all you want to say to her?
No, he's right. Well, because it's an IRA under your name. It's a special type, a simple, but has some extra rules. That two-year rule is unique to the simple, where you can't transfer it to another retirement plan until 2 years after it's been opened. Otherwise, there's a big penalty, actually. But
it's
like
25%.
The second worst penalty. The worst penalty is the 50% penalty for missed RMDs. 25% is pretty hefty, much higher than the normal 10% early withdrawal penalty from retirement plans. But that even if that rule wasn't in place, the answer is yes still, because it's part of this big IRA pool that the IRS considers you to have. Even though you might seem to have a lot of different flavors of IRAs, maybe an IRA at Charles Schwab and an IRA at Vanguard, an IRA at Fidelity, and your simple IRA at Edward Jones, who knows, you know, a lot of those little simple plans were set up places like that for small employers. To the IRS, you have one big pool of traditional IRA money out there, even though you might think of it as cut up into these little pieces. So for purposes of determining the pro rata rule, so moving money out of it comes out pro rata or based on the percentage it represents pre and post tax from these traditional IRAs, that all gets munged together. It all gets included together in that calculation. So
okay, let me delve into the mud a little bit here. Not mud.
On this topic still, or a new one?
No, this topic. Where am I delving? The weeds. Weeds,
okay.
Not mud. Mm-hmm. I guess mud would have worked too.
Sure.
Okay, so I'm just guessing. Now, I could be totally wrong, listener. You're in one of two situations. If you have a simple IRA, you are probably working for a small employer. Because they are designed, and I think limited actually, to 100 employees or less. So you're either with a small employer, but you're making damn good money because you're earning too much to contribute to a Roth on your own, Roth right. IRA on your own. So you could be working for a small employer, but pulling in some good money, or you're self-employed and you have created a simple IRA on your own. It's going to be one or the other. If you are self-employed and you have a simple IRA, and your earnings that you're making through your self-employment is keeping you from contributing to a Roth, hence you're trying to do the back door, open a solo 401k. Now you must wait until your simple IRA is 2 years old. So if you said it isn't 2 years old yet, so it's got to be less than two, obviously, because right. if it was two, it would be two. I don't know if you've got another year to wait, if you have another year and 11 months to wait because it's brandy new. But I don't know how much money you have in the simple, but if it's less than 2 years old, you probably got less than $50,000 in there. You probably have less than $25,000 in there. So you might not have that much in there. But still, once the simple is 2 years old, move it into your new solo 401k. Mm-hmm. Set your solo 401k up to allow transfers in, and you will be able to move that money from your simple into the solo 401k and then begin doing the back door. Leave it in the solo 401k. You don't want to move it back out. But once it's in, it will not be considered part of the pro rata rule that Charles Schwab's website was saying, that all your IRAs, all your IRAs were going to be looked at as one and under a conversion subject to the pro rata rule, as Chris just explained. So move that money to a solo 401k if you are self-employed. Get rid of the simple. However, if you are working for an employer who is offering the simple, chances are there are other highly paid people working for this employer, if not the owner of the company themselves, who would benefit if there was no simple and instead just a 401k that would also allow all everyone to transfer these simples into the 401k once they're 2 years old, and eventually do the back door. So what I'm saying is, now if your employer is very large, they may not want to deal with this. But if you're dealing with a small employer, maybe there's just a handful of you and you're highly compensated, successful professionals, y'all might want to sit together and start talking about this and, hey, could you benefit from this? Could you? Maybe we need to relook at this and as a firm start offering a 401k instead of the simple, so other highly paid people who want to be able to do the Roth can do it twofold. The Roth you can set up as a Roth 401k option, mm-hmm. and you'll be able to set up and do the backdoor option. So I'm just trying to think mm-hmm. outside the box here, that simples is such a specialized, narrow niche of the retirement account market. You usually see them with smaller firms. Right. And because of that, you might be able to, especially if it's just your firm, get rid of the damn thing when it's 2 years old. But in the meantime, get your 401k established and be ready to move the simple into it. And that will solve the problem. But if you are with an employer, perhaps a little bit of talking with the mm-hmm. employer, who could be in a very similar situation but has never thought of this, would say, hey, wow, yeah, let's evaluate the pros and cons. Now, granted, a solo 401k or even a traditional 401k, if it's a multi-employee firm, is going to be a more expensive option than the simple. I will admit that. But it is not overly and brutally expensive. There's a lot of custodians that offer safe harbor 401ks. They're relatively inexpensive. Yes, it's going to cost more than what your current employer is paying, but it's not to the point where it's, oh my God, it's so much money, we're never going to consider this. But it is a little bit more administrative cost, I will admit.
Right.
But just a suggestion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not too muddy.
No, just but, yeah, figured good. I would throw
yeah,
that out there.
Good idea.
Okay. All right. How about another question? I'm trying to find the... No, we'll skip that one. Okay, here is one that begins, hello, Jim. Totally written you off of this one.
Hope they don't want my input.
Hello, Jim, from beautiful wine country.
Kentucky?
Nope. Temecula, California.
Temecula.
Temecula? How the hell did you know that?
Because I've been there.
You've been to Temecula?
Yeah.
For what? I don't even know where the hell it is.
Driving around.
What'd you do?
I've been to most places. Haven't. Well,
do you ever been to Kentucky?
Just the very corner momentarily. I wasn't there much.
Hmm.
The place where I was. Yeah, no. I've been there a little.
All right. Well, anyways, hello, Jim, from beautiful wine country, Temecula.
Temecula.
Temecula. Well, they spell it Temecula. From wherever, California.
Yeah.
I was listening to a recent podcast and something Chris said was unclear.
What?
All right, something you said, but I think they meant okay. Chris.
Okay, we'll see.
I think. I was listening to the podcast and something you said, i.e. Chris, was unclear. Did Chris say...
Stop putting me as part of this.
Did you say if grandparents had put their grandchildren as beneficiary of their Roth IRA, they would have to cash it out immediately upon the death of the grandparents? So the grandkids will not even get the 10 years under the new law. We had our mother take her Roth of $200,000 and name all four grandchildren as beneficiaries so it could stretch over their lifetimes. I understand the stretch has gone away, but now if the grandkids were to have that cash right away, I think it would be better to switch it back. So, what I think what she means is she's under the impression the kids have to cash it in right away. I think it would be better to switch it back so we could get the extra 10 years and then just gift the money to our kids like she always wanted. So here we have someone with a $200,000 IRA, or someone's mother who has a $200,000 IRA. The mother wants to get the money to the grandkids, four grandkids.
Yep.
So essentially each grandkid's going to get $50,000.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, this listener's under the impression that Chris said on a previous podcast that under the Secure Act, the grandkids will now have to close that inherited IRA immediately and take all the money out immediately. So this person is saying, because of Chris misspeaking, this person is saying, should we switch it back to me as beneficiary? I can stretch it out over 10 years and then just gift the money to my grandkids. Do you want to fix the mistake? You clearly misspoke.
Well, I clearly remember you having that conversation. I'm pretty sure where the confusion came in is you were, as part of that same conversation, talking about if they did away with the stretch completely, that you might have to be disgorged immediately. And we were also tying it into a trust.
Exactly.
With
it's
the trust. Yeah. So that's where it kind of got mingled together. So no, there's still the regular stretch, of course, is gone, but the 10-year rule would still apply to the grandkids. They're not a, what is it?
Eligible.
I was thinking exceptional designated beneficiary.
And but, remember, but, listeners, grandchildren can never be the new eligible designated beneficiaries and never will get any type of exemption to the 10-year payout unless the grandchild is disabled. Then the disabled person will get it.
Right.
But naming grandchildren as beneficiary on your IRA, they will always, always be subject to the new 10-year stretch out. Your children...
Well, short stretch, we'll call it.
Short stretch. Your children could delay the beginning of the 10-year time period until they reach the age of majority.
Which in this case isn't possible because they have kids.
Right, so the kids are going to be past the age of majority. But I'm just saying, in general, you can name your Roth or traditional IRA, name your kids if your kids are minors. Let's say you passed away and your kids were 10. The kids are okay until they reach the age of majority, which for most states is 18 to 21. Then the 10-year clock begins. But if you name your grandkids and they're 10 years old and inherit it, they have to close that new inherited IRA within 10 years, no ifs, ands, and buts,
right,
unless they're disabled.
Right. So these balances are low enough where the distributions will be, you know, I guess if you make them take it out evenly right now, they'd get $5,000 a year for 10 years, assuming no further growth. So that might be manageable. You could certainly do what you mentioned, which is have it go to you and then you gift it to them. These are small enough numbers that there wouldn't be a huge concern there. But if they wanted to pay directly, you might actually... assets of the child have a more drastic effect on the FAFSA. Not that we're education planners here. But just a little side note, as we each try to get a little bit into the weeds on some of these questions, there might be a reason to avoid naming the grandchildren if they have potential of getting financial aid, which if they inherited a batch of money like this, even if they're able to stretch it out, it's still going to be counted. The assets of the child have the most drastic effect, more so than assets of the parents, when you're doing the FAFSA, which is the college financial aid application. So just a little side note, there might be a different reason why you might want to have your mother name you as the beneficiary rather than the grandkids directly, if that is even potential. Now, if they aren't going to need financial aid, it's not going to be an issue, that nothing to worry about. And we don't know how old they are. Maybe they're out of college already. We don't know.
She didn't say.
Yeah,
he didn't
I don't know
say.
About
I
that.
Don't know.
But just a little side tidbit, since we're playing that game today, apparently, something to consider.
Well, I always go into the weeds. You don't. But
well, it's been left out.
Well, you owed it because you screwed up this question to begin with, according to the listener. And
according to the reader of the email.
The reader of the email is a
That's
very,
you.
Very nice person. But I don't know anything about FASA and college planning, so I'm not even going to try to opine. But what I do know is I found the question I wanted to get to, and we have a whopping 10 or so minutes left before we have a appointment here together. You and I have an appointment in the office. So I want to get to this because I thought it was a good question. I like his line of thought. Now, it's a very long email, as you can see, so I'm going to truncate. Yeah, don't look at it
We're
that way.
We're not going to get done with that in 10 minutes.
It's an easy question, okay. But he sets the stage.
Okay.
So I'm going to do a lot of what I call truncating, which is making this shorter. Jim and team. Well, you've been delegated to the team.
That's fine. At least I'm in there, unlike the last one.
Well, it's because he was throwing you under the bus on the last one. Jim and team. I have been enjoying the podcast for a couple of years since I saw it recommending on Boggleheads. What the hell's Boggleheads? Is that the...
That's the Vanguard forums.
Oh, okay. Okay, I have been enjoying the podcast for a couple of years since I saw it recommended on Boggleheads. Sounds like a show, doesn't it? I knew a Bogglehead was a Vanguardian.
It's a website, people dedicated to the visions of
John Bogle.
John Bogle.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So I guess it would be Boggleheads.
I enjoy the detail you give in your answers as compared with other advisor planner podcasts. I'm hoping I can get your opinion on a strategy I'm considering. It is a bit complicated. It is a bit more complicated than I am going to propose here with the number of annuities and the number of beneficiaries involved, but I will explain it simply here. Let's say my mother, widowed and well past retirement age, has $300,000 in a non-qualified annuity. Now, let me stop there. Non-qualified annuity, folks, means This woman has money in an annuity that is not inside a retirement account.
Right.
Most likely an IRA. It's not inside an IRA. It's just on its own, mm-hmm. sitting there, mm-hmm. non-qualified annuity.
Yeah.
She has not annuitized it, and because of all her other income and assets, she doesn't even need to take any money out of it. Hmm. She is receiving 3.5% fixed interest, although there may also be a variable option. So what he's saying there is the mother's annuity. Here's one key thing with a annuity not inside an IRA, folks. There are no required minimum distributions right. while you're alive.
Correct.
You just sits there mm-hmm. and grows tax deferred, not tax free. It grows tax deferred. But unlike a qualified annuity or an IRA, money inside a retirement account, or what we call always taxable account, there are no required minimum distributions for the account owner. So the mom can let it sit there. Mm-hmm. Mom's earning 3.5%, which tells me this annuity is quite old, because the fixed accounts of annuities today is not paying 3.5% guaranteed. So the annuity is probably purchased at least 15 years ago or more, I'm guessing. But the annuity also has a variable option, meaning she could take it out of the fixed and invest it if she wanted, and it might rise or fall. Okay, so I'm just setting the stage of that. So now he's asking, her current beneficiary designation is 50% to me, her son, and 25% to her two grandchildren. So I'm guessing the son has two kids himself. So 50% to him, 25% to each kid. Mm-hmm. However, when the time comes to inherit, the beneficiaries will have to take distributions over 5 years. And he is correct on that. So here's the trade-off to having this non-qualified annuity that the mom has never been forced to take money from. When a non-spouse beneficiary inherits the account, and the non-spouse is the mm-hmm. son, 50%, and the two grandkids, 25 and 25, mm-hmm. when they inherit it, because it's under a non-qualified mm-hmm. structure, it's not in an IRA, you must close the annuity within five years of inheriting it,
or
within 1 year of inheriting it, annuitize it. In other words, give up the inheritance and instead take a lifetime stream of guaranteed right. income.
Right.
So you got those two options
yeah.
to consider.
You have a couple choices.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So he goes on. The way I see it, I will be taking about $30,000 per year. And he factored that in, 50% of 300 divided by 5. Now he has to factor in 3.5% annual growth between now and mm-hmm. the unfortunate passing of his mom, but he's correct in his assumption. And I will have to take those distributions and pay income tax on it at my marginal rate. And yep. at that time, my marginal rate will be fairly high.
Mm. Yep.
So what I'm thinking about is having my mom change the designations, the beneficiary designations, to just her two grandchildren. And I'm assuming this listener means his two children. But I could be wrong. Maybe one is his and one is his sister's or whatever. I don't know. To just the two grandchildren. At that time, meaning the time that his grandchildren or his children would inherit it, at that time, they should both be out of college and have jobs that presumably should offer them access to a retirement account like a 401k, 403b, 457, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially,
I like where he's going with this.
Essentially, I'm thinking they could take the $30,000 annual distribution they will have to take each and use it to help fund their retirement accounts.
Right. And it's fund is kind of in air quotes.
Correct.
Because they're going to really raise their contributions to the retirement plan, which will give up current income for them, but to live on, they are going to be backfilled with the annuity payout. So that's why it's kind of giving them the ability to aggressively fund the retirement plan because they've got this other income they can rely on for living expenses.
Exactly. And he asked, does this make sense? Do you think they'll gain enough to make this worth it?
Sounds glorious to me.
By the way, the grandchildren will also receive some other assets from my mom's estate, so they're not really being forced, quote-unquote forced, to put everything they are gifted into a long-term deferral product. So what he's saying is, under his idea, for what I think of his kids, I could be wrong, where he's going to explain to them, look, yeah, you inherited $300,000, $150,000 each from your grandma. And under rules, you have to close this within 5 years. So we could take $30,000 a year. And then you raise, like Chris said, raise the contributions you're making to your retirement accounts and get most, if not all, of that money in. You're not going to get it all in, and he's going to have to recognize that.
And maybe they'll have the Roth option so that they could fund the Roth.
Right, but
and,
let's keep in mind that right now the children are going to be able to defer, what is it, about $19,000?
Yeah.
They're getting $30,000. So there's still going to be about $21,000 that they might be able to get in but not deducted. Remember, you can put up to, gosh, I don't know these numbers because I just Google them, but it's like $56,000 now that you can get into a 401k, but you can only deduct. Is it 19 or 19 and a half? Somewhere around
there. I think
it's
19 and a half for 2020.
But whatever the case is, they'll be able to deduct some of that 30, listener, but not all of it. They're not going to be able to deduct all of the money going in because the government limits the amount that they can deduct. Now, that said, they could still get more money into the 401k if the 401k allows additional contributions, but they're not going to be able to deduct it. So out of your simplified scenario, out of the 30,000, is it 19 or 19?
19.5.
Okay. Mm-hmm. They're still going to have to pay taxes on $10,500.
But they might be wanting to pay tax on all of it. It just is going to allow them to get, think of it as doing effectively Roth conversions on that annuity
money.
Right, no,
I agree. I still like the idea. Yeah. You're going to teach your kids that, hey, this money coming out of the annuity is going to be taxable to you. Max out your contribution to your Roth, excuse me, to your traditional IRA. That's going to allow at least $19,500 of the 30 to be effectively received tax-free. But then the other monies still get into a retirement account as a long-term saving. And then here's some other money that you inherited that you can use. I like your thought process, but the kids are not going to be able to deduct the full $30,000. That's the key.
And if they're early in their careers, that might be perfect. They might be able to make contributions and not deduct them, thus Roth, and then backfill with this. So they essentially get all that money for the next 30, 40 years of growth tax-free.
Absolutely.
Depending on what their situation is, they may not even want to do it as deductible contributions.
Correct. What Chris is saying, it may happen, and I'm not hoping that your mom passes away anytime soon, but what if something happens sooner rather than later? Your kids might still be in a relatively low bracket to where they're going to be 30 years later, and they may not want to deduct it, is what Chris is saying. You don't just look at their tax bracket in the year they inherit it. Look at what your kids have become. You clearly are a high earner. Are they going to be as successful as you? Are they going to be doctors or attorneys or engineers? Nowadays, some computer programmer working for Apple? Are they going to be pulling in some buka bucks? And if the case is, then earlier in their careers, they may want to pay the taxes and get that money into Roth options because later in life, they're going to be in much higher brackets. So don't just do the tax planning around where they are when they inherit it. Do the tax planning about where they're going to be, especially if they're going to marry. Now they're going to have joint income. And maybe they'll marry someone equally as successful, and they could be in really high brackets and getting a lot of that inheritance into a Roth earlier would be better. So I like your strategy. You're essentially saying, look, I, meaning you, I'm going to be taxed to high heaven on this. I don't really need the money. I want it to get to my kids. Granted, I could inherit my $30,000 a year for 5 years, pay taxes on it, and give the money to my kids if I wanted, but that makes no sense from a tax standpoint. So for you to defer your inheritance by having your children, I'm assuming they're your children, your mom's grandchildren named directly as beneficiary and bypass you, I have no problem with that. You might be able to even disclaim, name yourself as primary still, disclaim to the contingent beneficiaries. However, your mom's going to want to confirm with the insurance company that they will accept a disclaimer. And I don't know, can you disclaim a non-qualified annuity? That I don't know. I've never heard you.
I don't know off the top of my head.
But that would be a question. And when you call the insurance company to check on this, do not go by the person who answers the phone. They're not trained enough for this. You want the advanced market section. So all you say to them, hey, thank you, I've got a really advanced question, and they're going to want to know what the question is. So tell them, because they ain't going to know the answer. And get an advanced market representative on there. Mm-hmm. You want to know if the insurance company would offer a disclaimer. Why is that going to offer some benefit? What if one of your children doesn't quite turn out the way you hoped? Or the way your mom hoped, by you still inheriting half, you could say, whoa, wait a minute. I don't want that kid to get that inheritance. So I'm going to take this inheritance. A disclaimer, you have 9 months after inheriting an asset to say, I don't want it. And you don't get to choose where it goes. It has to go to the next in line, which in this case would be 50% to one child and 50% to the other child. You can't choose which child. This one gets it all, this one gets nothing. No, it gets to the next in line. So disclaiming will work. It's got to be the same to both. You can't disclaim for one child and not the other, unless your mom could break that annuity into two.
Yeah.
However, I doubt she'll be able to do that because an annuity is a legally binding contract.
Yeah.
It's not a separate account, even though it looks like one to you, and you can't break a legally binding contract. So she's not going to be able to break it into two $150,000 annuities. But what I'm saying is if you're a little unsure on leaving everything to the kids, the disclaiming strategy could work.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going to try, you have to make sure the annuity company will, number one, accept a disclaimer, and number two, you can disclaim a non-qualified annuity. I have never heard you cannot disclaim a non-qualified annuity, but I would just want to make sure with the insurance company they'll accept it. Now, that's getting way into the weeds of deep planning. But for your basic question, I like the strategy, but just recognize that your children aren't going to be able to deduct or lower the taxes on all of it. But like Chris said, that might be a moot point. Don't look at where your kids are when they inherit it. Look at where they're going to be 20, 30 years from then. And you might want to encourage them to direct the annuity payments, pay taxes on it, and get it into a retirement account.
Okay.
That was it.
Perfect. Well, with that said, you might want to head down to our appointment, and I'll wrap things up here. We always want to thank everybody for listening. Today was a great show. We got through 7-8 questions, which has got to be a record for us, at least in recent times, and a couple of live calls. So we need to asterisk this one as one of our favorite shows, maybe, because we got all kinds of great stuff going on this show. And we want to remind everybody that we are living, breathing, practicing financial planners here in Northern Colorado. We service clients throughout the country, though. So if you're interested in a little bit more of what we do, you can check out our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, HELPS.com. On there, you can read a little bit more about the team, our retirement planning philosophy, if you will, and look at the services that we provide. And if you're interested enough, you can schedule what we call a coffee and a second opinion, which is a free introductory meeting where we'll talk to you a little bit more about what we do and discuss what your concerns or questions might be. And if we're a good fit, we can move forward. And if you're looking for something else, maybe we can direct you to a resource that can fit your situation a little bit better. So jimhelps.com, jimhelps.com. That's the best place to go. That's also a place you can submit your own questions for us to answer on the show. Or the phone number's on there. We usually tend to record the Q&A show live on Tuesday afternoons. The time varies a little bit, but it's usually between 1:30 and 2:30 p.m. is when we start Mountain Time here in Colorado. And if you want to be notified, the reason why these people were able to call in is they clearly have subscribed on the Mixlr app. That's M-I-X-L-R. That's the service or the app that we use to live stream the show. We do record it. Most of you listen to it actually after the fact as a recording in the podcast realm. But we do live stream it, and when we go live and start broadcasting, everyone that has signed up to follow us on the Mixlr system gets notified. So that's the way to really know when you can call in. But you can always call in ahead of time. Those actually work most smoothly when you call in ahead of time, and we can kind of get things set up and tell you exactly what time we'll get to you and those sorts of things. But always like to mention that we can, just like today, take live calls. We do have the technology to do so. So that's about it. So thanks, everybody, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jimhelps.com or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.